All I want to do is make a bag. Know what's up with me, no, not to fuck with me, so please don't come for me. It's heavy guns and luxury, this really get ugly. Foreigns bending corners comfortably, these bitches loving me. But I tell them all to suck a dick, you wasn't me. Off a city, but I be in Manchester too. I be busy being me for me to ever be you. Sucker new, I don't fuck with new. I'ma keep it brief. If I fuck with you, then you my brother and my mom's your mother new. Swag on a million feet. High, truth in the booth or in these streets. I will never let any new punk me. Why? Rather stand like a man in these streets or die. Whoever flossing, my whole team Boston. Shout out to the East Coast, upstate Boston. I respect realness, it's always about Fetty. This is for my hitters in the kitchen whipping Betty. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That good?
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to Criminal Justice Insider. I'm Babs Rawls-Ivy. And Jeff Grant is still recuperating, but he'll be back soon. And you will have him here with me. So today on Criminal Justice Insider, I am welcoming Andrew Clark, director of the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy at Central Connecticut State University. And we all know Mr. Dyson. He needs no introduction. How are
good
you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So Criminal Justice Insider is made possible by the sponsorship of the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven, now more than ever. Thank you very much. Thank you, Andrew Kaplan, for all that you do for us. And let's get right to it. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I haven't seen you, Andrew, in a long time.
It has been a while.
I haven't seen you since The Bodyguard.
The Bodyguard, Whitney Houston.
That was pretty damn good.
Yeah, it was.
Yes.
It was.
And I don't even know when the last time I saw you, Mr. Dyson.
Oh, gee, years.
I know, it's been years. Yeah. All right, so today we're going to talk about, this is Criminal Justice Insider, so I guess we're going to be talking about criminal justice kind of things and how policy is made.
All right.
Correct?
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit what you do. I could read it, but I want to hear you tell us what you do.
Okay. In terms of my work, I am at Central Connecticut State University. We have a public policy institute there. We're an independent organization in terms of we get our own funding, but we're a part of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what we do is we look to, according to our mission statement, effectively inspire and sustain a just, equitable, and inclusive Connecticut through independent research and evaluation, public policy analysis, development, and community engagement.
Okay.
And so what that means is we normally do it per project.
Uh-huh.
So we're funded on a particular project. And one of the ones that we have is the Connecticut Sentencing Commission. So we staff the Sentencing Commission. And we also staff and support the Commission on Racial and Ethnic Disparity in the Criminal Justice System. Those are two areas where some of my background came into play. I used to, and this is where I met Bill, I clerked at the General Assembly in Connecticut, actually three committees, finance, transportation, and ultimately appropriations, with where Bill was chair for.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found in that was a lot of people brought ideas to the table, but it was the process of taking those ideas and putting them into the action that was as meaningful, if not more meaningful. So getting information to the folks, making sure the meetings were run on time, making sure the public was aware of them. I found that very valuable at the General Assembly. I was lucky enough to have two mentors, Mary Finnegan in finance and Sue Keene in appropriations, that were tremendous public servants and showed me the value of that. So I thought that was an area that outside of the legislature, other organizations could use, and it turns out the commission is one of those, and the Sentencing Commission, same with the Racial and Ethnic Disparity Commission.
Mm-hmm.
We also implement the state's racial profiling law with traffic stops, or the Alvin Penn Act.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing that on utilizing a federal grant since 2011, shortly after the East Haven incident and Malloy's first election.
Okay.
So, and then we have a few more projects. One is children with incarcerated parents, where we've been funding services and developing best practices and policy for those children and their families impacted by incarceration. Because, as you well know, a lot of times the justice system is focused on the individual and without a real understanding of the ripple effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we also do cost-benefit work that might be a little bit more on the dry side, but again, the necessary side, and that's with the Pew and MacArthur Foundation. And then with our spare time, we also convene the Connecticut Reentry Collaborative, where I know you had Sue Gunderman and Beth Hines
yes.
a little while ago.
Yes.
And you know, they're chairs of their respective roundtables in Hartford and Waterbury, and there's, I believe, seven or eight now across the state. There's mm-hmm. one in New Haven here. So we help to bring them together so that they can share ideas and learn together and be an effective voice for folks coming out of the justice system.
So this is another layer of, I mean, we all are familiar with protests, civil unrest, and all that kind of stuff, but
yeah.
this is the next level of information sharing. It's one thing to have boots on the ground. It's another thing to sort of influence legislative activity. And so you gather data and run stuff to get the information out there so legislators could make better judgments about what should happen around these areas. Am I
agreed?
Hitting
yeah.
it?
Yeah, you're hitting it. And you put your finger right on it. And again, it's about process, and I think the most important thing is, yes, legislators may be, in terms of the end user in some of the areas, but really it's about who's at the table
mm-hmm.
And making sure that folks with a vested interest in the outcome have a voice, regardless of, you know, right, left, center. You know, everybody's got a lived experience. Everybody brings something to the table, and what we try to do is convene orderly processes whereby those folks can take information, share ideas, and come to the next level in finding out what they could do with a particular problem. And, you know, a lot of this also comes from an experience of looking at policy sometimes when it's driven by an anecdote. So there'll be an incident, something happening, and then you'll immediately see a bill that's put forth to attempt to rectify it. And then years after that bill's passed, you hear about the unintended consequences of what that actually did
mm-hmm.
and that it may not have even solved that problem. Because
well, we're starting to understand that now with that whole three strikes, you're out kind of thing
right.
and
right.
The war on drugs. And, you know, when we
right.
hyper mass incarcerated so many folks of color for 10, 20 years, and now we're starting to realize, well, maybe we shouldn't have
right.
done that, right?
Right.
So,
right.
So, Bill, you've been in the forefront of this way before the
yeah.
awareness was this high.
Yeah, I have, and I've tried to tell the story to many people.
Mm-hmm.
Mine started with my son, who was sentenced to 117 months. In prison, and how devastating that was. It's devastating to families or people impacted. It just wreaks havoc. And it didn't take much to go the next step and come to the realization that there are a bunch of families that are impacted by the justice system in a way that does more damage than the good they might hope to get from it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've experienced it, you know, and I know how painful it can be, you know, and I know what it can do to the person themselves, you know. It's not just that they are marginalized to beyond anything of sanity at all, but it's they're living a marginalized life from there on, and it's devastating. It's devastating, and there are talented people out there who made a mistake and paid the price for it, who are still being marginalized, and that's where I focus my efforts on listening to the marginalized people, to have them understand that there's someone that understands what it is that you're dealing with and are willing to recognize any contribution they have to make. And they have contributions to make. You know, they have insight that we have yet to see. And they have ideas that can have an enormous impact upon what goes on today. We just have to recognize that they're there. And I think we are turning the corner in terms of recognizing that.
Okay. You think we are?
I think we are. I think it's not something that's whispered about anymore.
Okay.
It's something that's talked about.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people are starting to think about when do people stop paying for their mistake, even after they've served their time? Like, what's the end of that?
Right.
You know.
You know, you mentioned whether or not the war on drugs are, you know, what were the unintended consequences? A number of people will say those were actually the intended consequences to get certain people behind bars. I fully believe in my heart that that wasn't the public's intended consequence. I think they reacted and they heard their leaders and they followed them sometimes out of fear. And I think what you're finding now is that is not a great direction to follow. And that if you are empowered with a seat at the table, with information, and with a belief that you can actually accomplish something for the greater good, and that it's not a win-lose, it could be a win-win, then there is a way out of these situations. And I think you're finding that now. But you point out something in terms of the protest versus getting something done. And I think that next phase is connecting. Because as I see it, you know, I've always worked within the system. I didn't intend that. That's just where I ended up. And I worked for change within there. And within the system, you have all sides. So in order to do something, you have to pull them together to move forward. If you want a revolution, you don't need all sides. You just need a really strong one side. And good luck with that, because the fact is, if you create that massive change, well, they're going to ask you to pick up the pieces too. And you better have a plan for that. And unfortunately, sometimes the plan for that at the end is marginalizing other people. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, I mean, so there is a way out. But you got to roll up your sleeves. You got to be willing not just to vote, but to be at your PTO meeting.
Follow through.
You got to follow through.
And you got to show up at all the things that this issue touches, right. I think.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not because hypermass incarceration doesn't happen just at the drug dealing phase. It happens with not showing up to PTA meetings. It happens not showing up for management team meetings, not showing up for all the community sort of things that happen to sort of help the community be a better community.
Right. And sometimes it's also meeting people where they're at. Because I understand full well, especially now that we've done a lot of work on the racial profiling initiative, I can't imagine growing up black and experiencing America and not being pissed off and not feeling that the intention is there from people to marginalize you. But
I feel it every day at 55.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 55 years old. I'm not a kid, but I experience it. I experience the micro and macro aggressions every single day I walk out of my house.
Right. And it's frankly amazing to me that pot hasn't boiled over quicker.
Because black people are peaceful people by nature.
Right?
We are forgiving, peaceful people, because we would have burnt this country down a long time ago.
That's what people don't get. Like, white people don't get that. You don't realize, like, Ferguson is not just that one incident, people.
Yes, yes. And so when we talk about those kinds of things, I mean, we just want, you know, I had James Foreman on a couple of months ago. You know, he wrote, and Locking Up Our Own. And it was such an illuminating thing, because I understood what was happening. You know, I grew up in Church Street South, and the drug game was strong. And I don't think people meant to sort of harm these young kids. They just wanted the drug dealing and the violence to stop in their communities. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that was, all right, we lock some of them up.
Right.
But they didn't realize locking them up meant 20 years.
Right.
Right? And so they go in, no skills, no nothing. Some of them didn't even graduate high school, blah, 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 blah. 20 years, they're coming out, and they're, you know, these people are 40, almost 50 years old.
Right, and that's the tough on crime movement. And so what that perpetuated was this notion in the General Assembly, I'm sure it happened in Congress as well, is, well, let's say the school drug zone law was created, right?
Yeah.
So first it was 1,000 feet, and then it's like, well, why don't we do 1,500 feet? Oh, right. Okay, there's no good argument not to do that. Well, what's your argument for it? It doesn't matter, because we feel like we're
doing
being
it
tough.
Right.
And then why don't we add nursing homes? Yeah, because we don't want grandma to be injured by this too, right?
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And then public housing? Yeah, of course. And then you go back and try to unravel this stuff in conversations with policymakers, and you make a tremendously cogent, informed argument as to why this doesn't make sense. And sometimes it's tough to move people out of, like, well, why did you do it in the first place? What's your rationale there?
Mm-hmm. But I think people feel like that somehow or other, that they feel safer knowing that people who commit crimes will go to jail, and they will go to jail for a long period of time, regardless of what the crime is. Like, they don't care what the crime is. They just want people to pay and then pay.
Well, that means then that we allow people to take a simplistic view of things. But I wish I could have people go with me to prison to listen to prisoners talk about what their life experiences have been. And I had experience maybe 3-4 weeks ago to take my class to prison, and there we sat listening to about 8-9 people talk about their lives, and man, you could see it in the lives of a whole bunch of people who were not locked up, but these are people who are engaged in a life in prison, because you don't serve 60 years and live after that. You know, it's life in prison. And then there was one young guy in the group who was born in prison. And there he was in prison now himself, which meant his mother must have been in prison. So you can see how we destroy the lives of people without them having an opportunity or chance to even explore what their potential is.
But then the thing in America, a lot of the fallback goes to, well, it's on the individual to make it right. Just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you wouldn't have been here in the first place.
And that's easily said by some. I had this young woman who came to talk to my class, and she was on the street at 11. You know, that's what she knew. Here she is later, 50 years old, and in the meantime, before she went in, there was a kid. She comes out 25, 30 years later, and what do you got? You know, she went in young. Her kid probably go in young. It's sort of like a cycle of destroying family and family structure, you know, that it's going to be difficult to try to make it well again, you know. But I think we can, and we start by not marginalizing people. realizing everybody can make a contribution.
You're so hopeful.
Yeah.
I'm starting to lose my hope.
Yeah.
I'm not.
It's hard for me. I used to be very optimistic, but this last 2 years of this administration and everything that I've seen, it stuns that I'm seeing this in my lifetime, because I'm post civil rights. So yeah. I thought we've come a long way, and I feel like, ooh, yeah. I don't feel safe in America. That's my point. Yeah. So I don't. My optimism is waning a little bit.
Yeah,
I've been there, done that on a lot of stuff, and I agree. Civil rights stuff. I've been arrested a bunch of times around civil rights issues. Today, the young people may not be as familiar with what that was, what they can do with that, how to go about doing it, the investment that you make, the fear that goes with it, the strength you need to have. It's not just, singing Kumbaya. It's committing oneself to making a difference.
I see young people coming up, though. They're coming up.
Yes, they are.
I've seen the Black Lives Matter kids. Right. I've seen the Black women movement. I've seen the kids from the shooting in Parkland, and they have really mobilized. Yeah. So, in that regard, I feel hopeful. But on the other thing, on the other side of it, though, I'm exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part and parcel of it is this. Is that we have created a society in which people have their noses to the grindstone because they must engage in struggle just to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of trying to make ends meet, at the end of the day, they are exhausted. And through that exhaustion, it limits the PTA meeting.
Yeah.
it eliminates the sitting and reading with. It eliminates a lot of things that young people need. And then the other side is that people are being marginalized. And you have to wonder, how many damn fights can I fight at one time? There's so many to engage in. And it's easy for people to want to give up the struggle.
And that's always been my point, because, I think oftentimes parents get a bad rap, like, they don't show up to meetings. But, I remember, my mother worked two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
She worked at American Linen full-time from 7 till 3. And then she worked at Yale Medical School from 4 to midnight.
Yeah.
And so it was a different thing. There was no, she knew all our teachers. She made a way to do that. But 4 kids is a lot. I have 4 kids. I made it a point to sort of be at their school. Some of their school boards I serve on. Some I'm part of whatever. And there is a little bit of time. There is no time to sort of do all these other things.
Right.
You can't be, protesting and trying to get homework done and trying to get kids to music, because you want a quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound like I'm making excuses, but there's so many challenges to trying to sort of move an agenda and to be a part of a movement.
Being a parent is not easy.
No.
It is not easy.
I grew up in the suburbs of Hartford in Farmington, but I've been living in Hartford in the Asylum Hill neighborhood for the past 20 some odd years. And it's got high poverty rates. There are people been murdered on my street. Plenty of things have happened. And I didn't realize the impact of that until I lived it, of what that must mean for families to not have a place of refuge at the end of the day when you're struggling with poverty and then you're not sure what's going to happen in the neighborhood. And then you're trying to get to the PTA meeting, but the system actually isn't set up to allow you to meaningfully participate in that.
Yes.
And so that's a struggle.
Yes.
And at some point, you just got to be like, well, maybe I'm just going to screw the whole thing. And that's where, Bill was talking about the individual and that And, you know, Governor Malloy has had this, the Second Chance Society. And, mm-hmm. and I wish for once what we would do with that is also not just put that on the individual and say, we need a second chance.
That's a good point, Andrew.
As a society.
That is a good point.
To make
point.
Things right.
Yes.
We're all in this together. Mm-hmm. We all created this. It wasn't you. Because if you put it on the individual, then you're saying one out of three black males was born a criminal?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
What did we do to create this? And what do we have to do to unwind it and to make it better? And one thing that was, you know, really heartbreaking for me was I went to, Bill talked about going into prison. And the first time I went in was when I was working for Bill. But I went in about eight years ago to the Wesleyan Prison Education Program in Cheshire. And there was an English teacher there teaching Greek tragedy. And one of the things that Wesleyan did was the DOC at the time wanted it to be a reentry program. So they wanted people to get some education so that they could hit the ground running when they were released. But Wesleyan wanted it to be a Wesleyan degree program. So they wanted the best students. So they didn't care if they were lifers or in there. They had to be in there for a minimum amount of time. So it was a whole range of folks that were in there, but they were smart, you know, and it was predominantly African-American, some Latino, a few white guys, and they were talking Greek tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience that they brought to that, the wealth of knowledge, the heart, the understanding, they had the, you know, all of those professors will say, these are the hardest and most rewarding classes I've ever taught. And what I took from it most of all was like, you had to be now that we gave them this opportunity.
Yeah.
That couldn't have happened before.
Yeah.
Because these are bright guys.
I know. And you know, and you've seen this too, Bill.
Yeah.
When you see, listen, y'all know I've done some time in federal prison. And the moment I walked in there, the second day that I was there, I realized that I was in the midst of some talented, amazing women. Like, just if, had they had the opportunity that I had, they would have gone far. Just talented, interesting, smart women. And I was thinking, man. And, you know, I've heard the story. Some of them, you know, prostitutes at 11 and 12 and,
right.
you know, drug mules at 15 and 16 and all these kinds of things. And the system never was for them. Like, they just were just pushed out. And never could recover. They had nobody to push them to the next level of what they could find successful for themselves. And so you hear these stories after stories. And I was like, yeah, I was like, man, if somebody would have just stepped into the pipeline at another entry point, they would not have been here.
No.
Do you know?
You know, it's funny because in certain circles, you know, it's, people go to therapists. I go to a therapist. And a lot of times what folks are talking about is how their dysfunctional family life created a dynamic that they have to work through right now. It doesn't take it off the individual that you have to do it, but there is some understanding that there was a system that created, through dysfunction, some of the things that you're struggling with, some of the trauma and all that.
Yeah.
I don't see it much differently with this.
Mm-hmm.
What was the dysfunctional society that these people are coming from? When do we have that conversation in a broader sense? Not out of necessarily blame, but understanding and wanting to heal and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know, we can't exclude the magnitude of the issue that we're talking about. When we I had, as I was saying before, I had two women who came to my class, and they just blurted out some information. Then they went on to talk about what they were doing. The information that they blurted out was that each of them went in with children that they had to leave, you know. And then you think about the number of people who are confined now, over 2 million, and if you could just associate one kid with each individual, you're talking 2 million kids.
Yeah.
You know, and 2 million kids with a disrupted life marginalized, or the parent has been marginalized, no sense of future, and there's appearing to be an unwillingness to understand and give them a break and help them along. We're just feeding a meal every day with young people.
Mm-hmm.
That just, it's mind-blowing.
And that system that they're in, because of that tough on crime movement, because of a huge buildup in beds without the corresponding services, has been built from a mindset of punishment.
Yes.
So you're not just in, you're not in there again to build yourself up. You're doing that in your own devices for the most part, because you're locked behind bars. You're in cages. You know, the dynamic is very disruptive to try to deal with trauma and try to get through and try to make yourself a better person. So, you know, imagine what that does to a parent on the way out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and to society, it always blows my mind that people are okay with that. And yet 90 some odd percent of people come out, and they're not as diligent about asking the question, well, where are they going out to?
Mm-hmm.
I think, you're okay with them going into a neighborhood being next door when you've just punished them and you haven't been really concerned about how well they're doing in there and if they're getting better?
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting that we have seen some of it take place and to the degree that it's just beyond devastating. When you think of taking a child from a parent at the border, separating them and sending them some other place, you apply that same situation to kids whose parents have been, they've been denied access to their parents, and where it is that they are left and what they are stuck with. It's no wonder that they all appear to be shocked, you know, and what is it that we are creating in the world today is a generation of people who have experienced being shocked, neglected, unwanted, marginalized. Just think of that aura that we provide for young people today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not everybody, but the numbers that are exposed to that is far beyond anything that we ought to be dealing with.
Well, yeah, especially, you know, in Connecticut has the highest disproportionality in terms of who's in prison. So think about double the average of blacks, just about that with Hispanics, and less than the average in white. And you see, when you say it doesn't impact everybody, but I've seen it, like, you know, with people in the white community that wouldn't know anything about incarceration, then all of a sudden their loved one was incarcerated, most likely for opioid, maybe DWI. And then they say to themselves, wait, this is it? Like, this is the system we created? Like, this doesn't make sense. And, oh, wait, that doesn't make sense. And, wait, that doesn't make sense. And they're outraged.
Well, you know, all activism starts from a personal place.
Yes, it does.
It starts from a personal place.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the thing that stuns me, I had this conversation because, you know, we do this show and we talk to people in and around this issue all the time. When men go to prison and they have children, somebody cares for those children. Somebody will take care of them. Grandmother, maternal, paternal, aunt, uncle. Somebody will take care of these kids. But when women go to prison,
right.
Fathers don't take their children.
Right. That's right.
Who takes care of these children? What happens to these children? And oftentimes, these children get into somebody's system, mm-hmm. Foster care system, until either mom can get out or somebody in the family can step up and take in these children. So that is a definitive difference between what happens to women when they are incarcerated and when men are incarcerated.
Right.
You know, if I could get people to read Bryan Stevenson's book,
Just Mercy.
Now, there is a story that he tells about this kid who was placed in prison and what that kid went through It's just mind-blowing. And not a lot done about it. Not a lot done about it. It's a good read for anybody who wants to read something. Read Just Mercy.
And you know, it's going to be a movie.
Oh, yeah?
With Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx. Michael B. Jordan will be the young Brian Stevenson.
Okay.
And Jamie Foxx will be the guy that was incarcerated unjustly for some years on death row without a trial.
Right. Right. Well, there's something worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
Worth
mm-hmm.
reading. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
As long as we're talking about books, I have to make a little bit of a plug here. Tonight and tomorrow, there's going to be a gentleman named Peter Edelman in town, and he was in the Clinton administration.
Is that Marion Wright Edelman's husband?
Yeah. That's him.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah. So he, a little bit of a backstory. I believe he was the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, and he resigned from the Clinton administration because of the welfare reform work that Clinton was pushing forward and the harm that he believed that it would actually do society. So now he's a Georgetown law professor, and he wrote a book called It's Not a Crime to Be Poor. So it talks about that intersection.
I did not know that. And now I have to go find that.
So, and he's going to be talking about the book tonight in the Mark Twain House in Hartford, but also tomorrow from 11 to 4 p.m., a group called Everyday Democracy is going to be hosting a dialogue with him. And I'm going to actually be moderating that, but Peter Edelman will be there, and as will a few other folks. Erica Tyndall, who's a judge.
I know Erica Tyndall.
Yeah.
Tell her I said hello.
I will. And Anna Maria, I think it's Rivera. She's for the Connecticut Bail Fund. Does tremendous work also on immigrant rights. So mm-hmm. it should be a good conversation, and I think there's still some spots left if people go to the Everyday Democracy site, but
where is this
in Hartford? But we'll also Facebook live stream it.
That'll be good. So, you know, before we wrap up, give me your thoughts about where we are in Connecticut around these issues, specifically about the work that you do, Andrew. Are we getting it right? Are we getting it wrong? Is Connecticut on the right path? I mean, do you see some light at the end of the tunnel?
Sure. So I think a lot of people, and rightly so, in the criminal justice community were very appreciative and have been appreciative of Governor Malloy for the stand that he took on criminal justice issues and the fact that he never wavered, supporting this notion that we can do better. And by doing better, we can incarcerate less people and we can have a system that's not based on mass incarceration and punishment. I think where it's fallen short is on the engagement of community and pulling the strings together in terms of what's happening with reentry, and are we making sure the front end in these communities is really addressed, and as well as the back end. And I don't think as much work was done there. I mean, there was a lot, but it was kind of scattershot. And I think a lot of people felt like they could have had a greater voice at the table there. And so I think there's an opportunity there because there's so many people with so much, like you said, lived experience. Now, that's one of the unfortunate things, but I guess an upside of mass incarceration. So many people have been affected. Now there's more people to mobilize against it.
Yes.
And so I think it just requires some leadership to pull that together, but also a willingness to pull people to the table. And I think, you know, from what I hear, I don't know Governor-elect Lamont, but just the notion of working with the legislature, the notion of working with the other side, I think will be very helpful. Because I think an adversarial relationship was set up in the past 8 years. And although that might be good for some things, I think right now what's necessary is to pull people together. And I think that will be done. And, you know, one of the reasons why I really wanted Bill to come to this is I learned so much from him in the process of how do you bring people together?
Mm-hmm.
And when we started this work, well, when I started it, he had, as you noted, been doing it long before me. We had Governor Roland in there who came in on tough on crime, but we got him to support the most significant criminal justice reform initiative called Justice Reinvestment. It's now a national thing. At a time when it looked like no one would be willing to support that. And it was voted with only like 4 votes against it in the House and unanimous in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was looking at the details. It was bringing people to the table. And so I don't want people to believe that you need a governor like we've had with Malloy to get this done. I think right now it's incumbent on all of us to put a plan out there and say, how are we going to move forward? And I think those pieces are there. I think the people are mobilized. I think the roundtables are doing a great job with that. There's other organizations too.
Mm-hmm.
And legislators. You have some key champions here in New Haven.
Yes, Robin Porter and Gary Winfield and Walker.
I'd like to add to that. And before we undertook this effort, you wouldn't believe that there existed out there in the broader public people who were as bright as they are, as knowledgeable as they are about what works and what does not work. And the thing that I feel so good about is that they do not mind speaking up today. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, they may have.
Mm-hmm.
Today, they're not. Which means now that they are willing to carry on with the struggle themselves. And they do not have to be led. They are leading. And I feel good that that is an accomplishment that would suggest that this effort, this undertaking will not die.
Mm-hmm.
It shall remain because of people that have come out now who refuse to be marginalized any longer, who know what it is that needs to be done and are willing to speak. I'd offer this as a caveat. It is helpful to have someone within the administration, inside the system, being receptive. And I can't think of a person beyond Governor Malloy than having Scott Semple.
Yes.
Scott Semple.
But he's leaving.
We need people like Scott.
Yes.
Without people like Scott
Semple. And he was here on the show talking. We had a good conversation with him about reentry and the nature of prison itself and how that has to change. And
he's just been an excellent person, a good person. I mean, you don't ask for people better than Scott. And if he's gone, I hate to see him go, but I would have it that the new governor-elect, think about trying to convince Scott to come back, to be there, you know, unless he got somebody that's better. Which I doubt. Scott is the example,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it's time that other people who recognize what Scott can do will speak up and say as much.
So, what are you hopeful about? What are you still? Because you've been in this, you have been on the forefront of this issue and many issues for all of your life.
I'm hopeful about people. I just don't think that people are genuinely evil or bad. I don't mistake. Yeah. But I believe in people, you know, and if you believe in people, they get it. They like it that, hey, you believe in me and they'll do the rest of it themselves. They do not have to be led around by the nose. They know what needs to be done. They have some sense of what to do to get there. They know what it is that's going on in terms of how they are being treated. They can tell you what it is you need to do to get off their backs. So I believe in people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe in people, that gets conveyed. They get it. They pick it up, you know, and that they feel good about themselves then. You know, so I just think I feel good about people.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That makes me feel hopeful. If you feel good about people, then I feel very hopeful. Seriously. If you are that hopeful, then I can dig deeper and be equally hopeful.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Thank you both. Andrew Clark, pleasure seeing you.
Yeah, same here.
Bill Dyson, My heart.
What can I
Thank
say?
You so much. So if y'all just tuned in, we're about to leave Criminal Justice Insider. Today, my guest was Andrew Clark and Bill Dyson, and we're having a wonderful conversation. Today's show was sponsored by the Community Foundation, now more than ever. Jeff Grant, I hope to see you soon. Feel better. Andrew Kaplan, thank you for all you do, and I will see you soon. Thanks, Harry.